a great deal of Jewish scholarship is interpretation, interpreting text. I don't know how many of you have come across this attitude, which is, I think, very widespread on campus and in what's lovingly called the postmodern culture, which is probably an oxymoron. If it's a matter of interpretation, then anybody can say whatever he wants. It's all subjective. It's just how you happen to feel about it. If it's interpretation is another word for free play. The idea is there are no rules of interpretation, there are no standards of interpretation. Interpretation is not right or wrong, correct or incorrect. If you have to interpret, then the sky's the limit. So that, in a whole school called deconstructionism, the principle was no text means anything. No text means anything. You just use it however you please. You, your group, your time. But the text as a text means nothing at all. It's hard to make this sound serious, but you should know that at Yale and other great universities, this was the ruling orthodoxy for years. And, people had conferences on this. The University of North Carolina is a hotbed of this kind of stuff. Now, let's see. Isn't it true that we have disagreements about interpretation? Yes, it is. And isn't it true, when we're talking about our sources, our commentators, our scholars, that we will treat all of the opinions with great respect? Yes, it is. So I guess we are not going to decide that this opinion is right or that opinion is wrong. Correct? We're not going to decide this opinion is right, that opinion is wrong. Well, here you have it. You have different opinions about what the text means, and you treat them all with respect, and you don't decide what is right and what is wrong. So, doesn't that show you that there is no right, and there is no wrong, there is no true, there is no false, there is no valid, there is no invalid? It's just a matter of what you happen to feel. It's all subjective. Now, I hope your guts are in a turmoil here. I mean, this is really nonsense. This is really rank nonsense. Yale Schmale. This is really nonsense. Let me give you some examples. I've said this to some of you before, and I'm going to repeat it. When you hear a grand philosophical thesis stated in abstract terms, especially one that has all sorts of political overtones, my recommendation is take the thesis and try to apply it to simple, everyday affairs. Everyday experiences, activities, where you feel very much at home, where you feel very much in control intellectually of what's going on, and see how they apply. And often you will come out with gigantic surprises. Now let's see. You might sign a contract. And in the contract, you're going to deliver me certain goods, and I promise to pay you $10,000 on the 15th of every month. So on February 15th, I march into your office with a box, and I say, here's your payment. And you open it up, and inside there are 15,000 fresh, crisp Monopoly dollars. So you say, listen, very funny, but, you know, where's my payment? And I say, there it is, it's $15,000. Where in the contract does it say that they can't be the Nafli Davis. If you write that down any place, that's how I interpret the contract. I interpret the contract as dealing with Nafli Davis. So you look carefully into the contract, it says, but it says U.S. dollars. And this monopoly stuff was manufactured in the United States. See, so they're U.S. monopoly dollars. Now, is that reasonable? Is anybody going to pay attention to that? If you go into court, is anybody going to give credit to that? Because everything's a matter of interpretation. And the written word has no meaning except beyond what gloss people put on it. Imagine a fellow who comes to you, he's distraught, he's gotten a letter, what they call a Dear John letter. And he says, you know, she's throwing me over, and my life is over, and what can I do? And his friend says to him, have I got good news for you? You made a terrible mistake. This isn't the letter to you. This is a shopping list. You see, John stands for cleaning powder, and I never want to see you again refers to getting window cleaner so she can see better out of the window. See, it's just a matter of interpretation. Interpret it my way and you have no problem. It's a shopping list. What's wrong here? What's wrong here is that documents are produced by people. And they're produced by people in the midst of human circumstances. And there are facts about those circumstances. This woman wrote you a letter. Either she wrote it or somebody forged it. And if she wrote it, she had something in mind. And what she had in mind is a matter of fact. And you want to know what it is. Because your immediate and long-range future depends crucially on what it is. And someone who makes up an interpretation of the shopping list is going to do you harm. Because you'll be out of tune with the real facts. The person who signs a contract, after all, is not the same as your diary. You write your diary for yourself. A contract is an interpersonal obligation in the context of a whole legal structure. And you know very well how it's going to be interpreted, and so does the person for whom you're signing it. That's why contracts work at all. And to come along later and say, I interpret it to be monopoly dollars, no one will even take you seriously that that's the way you interpret it. Unless by way of recommending you to a mental facility. But other than that, no one will take you seriously. Because that's not what it means. That's not what it means. Now, suppose someone raises at this point the same point that I raised vis-a-vis our text. But aren't there disagreements about contracts? Don't disagreements arise? Don't disagreements arise about laws? Doesn't the Supreme Court have work to do in the United States interpreting things? I won't say in this country because here it's just a farce. They don't interpret anything. They just stamp their politics on the country. But in the United States, there's at least some attempt to make it look like they're interpreting the laws. Don't they have work to do? They have work to do. So aren't there problems of interpretation in contracts? Yes, there are problems of interpretation in contracts. So, shall we then march all the way to the end of the road and say, therefore everything is play, everything is subjective, everything is a matter of feeling? Don't you see that we ought to stop somewhere in the middle? The fact that something is controversial, something is difficult, doesn't imply that everything is controversial and that everything is difficult. The fact that there are some unresolved problems doesn't mean that the whole area is an area without rules, without standards, without validity. It just means that within this area, there are some very difficult problems. After all, there are outstanding problems in physics. Difficulties and disputes in physics, especially in quantum mechanics. No one wants to say that since there are unsolved disputes in quantum mechanics, therefore the whole of physics is just play. What you say is physics is a complex field. It has lots and lots of different levels of information in it. Some of it is well verified, some of it is more speculative, some of it is highly theoretical. And guess what? And you take each piece according to its status. Same thing is true with contracts. The fact that some items in contracts are controversial and can be debated doesn't imply that the whole thing is a joke. It implies only what it says, that some questions are difficult. That's true in any human discipline. Some questions are difficult. Even in mathematics, actually, which was my field of research, philosophy and mathematics. It doesn't mean that everything in mathematics is controversial. And the same thing is true with texts in general, and our texts in particular. The fact that there are differences of opinion about how to interpret particular texts, and those differences are represented by the greatest scholars, and we treat them all with respect, does not mean you can say just anything you like. It doesn't mean that it's totally up for grabs. Are there problems interpreting Macbeth? Shakespeare. Yes. There's no question that scholars debate certain aspects of Macbeth, have been doing so for hundreds of years. That does not mean that it's appropriate to suggest that Macbeth was a transvestite. That is not an item of a reasonable disagreement or reasonable interpretation. One other aspect before I turn to some cases to show you how it works in practice. The Gemara records an incident. A non-Jew came to Hillel and said to him, I would like to convert. I want you to teach me for conversion. But I only want to learn the written Torah. I'm not interested in the oral Torah. So Hillel, as he was interested in receiving people and encouraging people, said, okay, let's start with the alphabet. I'll teach you the alphabet. So the first day he taught him the first four letters. Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dal. So you remember those? Memorize those? Come back tomorrow at lesson two. Comes back the next day, and Hillel says, let's start with the review. Let's go through the letters. And this time, Hillel reversed the names. He called the Dalet Aleph, and he called the Beis Gimel. So the non-Jew said, but that's not what you taught me yesterday. So Hillel said, aha, so you have to rely on me to teach you what the letters are. Then the idea of learning the written without the oral is incoherent. It's an incoherent idea. Intellectually incoherent. Let's think. What is Hillel telling us? What is Hillel telling us? Let's take a document. Think of a document as a physical object. Okay, I'm skipping a lot of philosophy now. It is shapes of ink on paper or on parchment. What does it mean to say that this object has a meaning? This is an object. It might be tree rings. It might be pigeons walking in the sand. Who knows what it is? What gives this object a meaning? What gives it a meaning is that there is a living community of people that interact with it in a certain way, that use it in a certain way. Otherwise, as just shapes of ink on paper or shapes of ink on parchment, it has no meaning at all. Meaning is a human phenomenon. If you don't have the human context into which to put the shapes, there's no meaning at all. So Hillel said to the non-Jew, you're making a fundamental mistake, a philosophical mistake. You want to know the meaning of the text without reliance on the oral tradition of the community that interprets the text? Then it's just arbitrary shapes of ink. And arbitrary shapes of ink don't have any meaning at all. So there is no question that the meaning of a text relies upon, depends upon, its interaction with a community that uses it for a particular purpose. Let's suppose, again, back to Shakespeare, let's suppose someone took the plays of Shakespeare as an account of the history of Denmark. And they looked for kings with those names and incidents that he describes. They'd be very disappointed. Because this just isn't Danish history. Those things never happened. Is that a critique of Shakespeare? Not at all. Because he wasn't writing history. He was writing theater. Theater is not an attempt to give an account of real events that took place. Theater is an attempt to give a description of certain other aspects of human life. But not that aspect of human life. If you don't know the use that English society had for Shakespeare's texts, you don't know what they mean. You don't know how to take them. You don't know how to understand them. So of course, the text has to be understood in terms of the life of the community that uses it. There are certain portions of our literature that are poetry. Poetry has a different type of meaning, a different standard of meaning from prose sections. If you can't identify what is poetry, you will not know how to interpret the verses that we use, what they mean. So you have to know how it's related to the life of the community in which it's being produced. But that doesn't mean that the text has no integrity of its own, no fixed content of its own. It just means that you have to take the relationship to the community into account. It's sort of like saying, is there any side of the road on which it is absolutely correct to drive? Unless you're an American and you think, of course, it's the right side. But, you know, if you are a citizen of the world, you know that in some countries it's the right and in some countries the left. Correct. But now suppose I ask, is there any side of the road upon which it is absolutely correct to drive in the United States? Then the answer is clearly yes, the right side. That is the absolutely correct side of the road to drive on in the United States. And in England it's the left. In Israel it's the middle, and everywhere, all over. Once you fill in the context in which the question is being asked, the question gets a definitive, absolute answer. If you ignore the historical or societal context in which the text is being written and used, then of course you're going to run into trouble. You will not be able to pin down how to understand the text. But once you fill it in, the answers become definitive. It's no longer open for anybody to do as he pleases. Interpret whatever he wants. And the important thing here is you wouldn't tolerate this anywhere else in life. Only in universities, where what they do doesn't really count. But anywhere where real life counts. Imagine orders being given in an army. And the sergeant gets orders from the colonel, you know, to move out. And he says, oh, I think that needs to go on vacation. So, you know, we'll just take off the next 3 days. But I interpreted it. Isn't there a matter of interpretation? Not when you're fighting a war. It's too serious for academia. Well, then I think academia is disconnected from real life. Now, the bottom line here is, when you say it's a matter of interpretation, what you mean is we're applying a particular discipline, intellectual discipline, with rules, with standards, within which there can be difficult, unsolved problems, correct? But that doesn't mean that the discipline is free play. And when a text needs interpretation, when you give it and you give grounds for it, then you have good reason to think this is what it means, or this may be among the very few acceptable understandings of what it means. Everybody with me up to here?
So you're saying maybe that Torah is better because it's so limited in what its derivation sometimes can be?
No. I'm now saying something about interpretation in general, and this could apply a lot to the Constitution of the United States. It could be, when you have debates about the gun clause, the gun amendments in the United States, that doesn't mean that a person could say that I interpret the Constitution to mean that elections are optional and that from time to time we can appoint people without elections.
What was the view that that was the majority, though?
You're raising an important point. I don't know how much time I want to dedicate to it, but let me just say, in any intellectual endeavor, it is possible, I would say it's most common, that the majority is wrong. So the fact that the majority thinks something is really not much of a recommendation at all. Anything that's beyond the trivia of everyday life, who really knows what's right about sailboating? The majority or the minority of people. Only a tiny minority who know how to sail boats.
It's just the sky is green or something, right? I mean, obviously, it'd be blue.
But even more than that, where people have opinions, like economics, right? The vast majority of people are incompetent to have any opinion. I would say everybody is incompetent because it's not a science, but that's my view only. The vast majority of people are incompetent to have an opinion in economics, and therefore the vast majority of people's opinions are going to be just dumb. So the fact that the majority of people hold a position is really no recommendation whatsoever. As I always say, if you have a billion critics with one reason, that counts as one. If you have one critic with three reasons, that counts as three. Don't count people, count reasons. Ask the people, what reasons do they have? There are far more anti-Semites than there are Jews. I hope that doesn't give you some sleepless nights. Maybe we really are evil, you know. Maybe we really are vicious. Because there are hundreds of millions of anti-Semites. So maybe, you know, just maybe they're right. Don't count people, count reasons.
But you can still look at how quickly you disregard the people, though.
Sorry?
Even though the people, like, if someone to come up and if one person says in life, like, newspaper, I think this column's great. So one person still has some validity as representing a bunch of people. Like,
yeah.
Those people may not hear this, one person does.
Look, there you're talking about popularity. And the newspapers in the business of selling newspapers, and they will be concerned that people buy it. That has nothing to do with being right or wrong. We started with a matter that's a subject of right or wrong.
This idea, don't count people, count reasons, this isn't an idea that's too welcomed in the society, is it? How is it that you would figure out when it is appropriate to speak to somebody saying this when you're having a debate with somebody? And it was proven, you know, the story of Avraham and the Torah, right? Everybody said idol worship was the right way, and he was the only one who said no. You know, that's the whole world against him. But, I mean, if he has something else, I can't come up with an example right now. But there's a bunch of people that say yes to one thing. There are a couple people who have a couple different reasons to say no. How, I mean, is it even worth it to go into them about...
If you're on campus, you better keep quiet. Because they don't tolerate difference of opinion. They don't tolerate discussion. They don't tolerate debate. You should see. Amnon Yitzchak has a wonderful film that he made at the Hebrew University where he sat there for 2 hours and seven or eight students shouted him down for 2 hours and wouldn't let him speak. This is the freedom of thought and freedom. He's banned on many universities in this country.
Who's
because Amnon Yitzchak.
Was he,
He's a fellow who was a lawyer and had hair down to your shoulders and everything else, became frum, and now he goes out trying to explain the Torah to people. And he was invited by a student's group, and he sat there. They have the whole thing filmed, and he shows it. And they were just wouldn't let him speak, yelling and screaming for 2 hours, not to let him speak.
The people who were there listening to him.
The students who came. Some students came to protest and yelled and screamed for 2 hours, so that he would not be able to speak.
Was he able to speak?
No, I mean he said some things, but you couldn't hear him because they were yelling and screaming.
That was one night where we got a lot of people.
Yeah, that's when he has his own, he takes a place on his own. But I want to show you now some examples of what it means to interpret. How you can learn to take the words seriously, analyze, debate, and deduce meanings which are really determinate. These are ideal cases, obviously. There are harder cases. But I want you to see what it means to go through the process of interpretation. Take a look on page 145. that you can get even in English, well, if you do it in Hebrew, you're better off, of course. Okay, now this is the microscopic analysis. This is just a few words at a time. We're looking at verse 12, just the first half of verse 12, up to the semicolon. And he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward. You can leave out, and he dreamt, and behold, just. A ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward. Okay, what does earthward mean?
Towards the earth.
Towards the earth, or to the earth. It doesn't mean on the earth. In Hebrew, arsaw is the same as el ha'aretz. A hey at the end of the word is the same as el in front. The word el. It means to the earth or towards the earth. A ladder was set to the earth. Towards the earth. Now, if the ladder was set to the earth or towards the earth, where is the ladder coming from? It would seem, unless you have some other candidate positions in between, the natural thing is to say it must be coming from heaven. If so, what am I going to do at the end of the phrase when it says the top reached heavenward? Heavenward means to or towards heaven. Does that now contradict what I said about earthward? Indeed. Doesn't the verse contradict itself?
Yeah.
Earthward and heavenward doesn't seem to fit well together, right? I mean, now look very carefully at the phrases, the two phrases. Gosh, it's all of 10 words. Look very carefully at the two phrases and notice that they are not parallel. They are not strictly parallel in such a way that there is really no contradiction here.
Because the second half it says ascending and descending?
No, I'm not coming to the second half yet. Just up to the semicolon. No more than the semicolon.
One place
and another. It doesn't say that. It just says one place. One end is at one place and one end is at another.
Oh, who's talking about ends here?
It says it's 12.
Ah, the second phrase it says its top reached. What does it say in the first phrase, parallel at the top?
It was set.
What's the parallel at the top? The ladder. In the first phrase, you're talking about the whole ladder. In the second phrase, you're talking about an end of the ladder. Correct. Now, how about the verbs? In the first phrase, the verb is?
Was set.
Was set. What's the verb in the second phrase?
Reached.
Are those parallel? Not at all. Was set describes something being put in its position. Reached describes what?
A journey.
Well, it might be a journey, but there's a ladder.
No, but that's right. I mean,
no, it's just getting
deeper. When you say something reaches, what are you describing?
Moving toward.
How big it is. How big it is. How long it goes. I come to a road and I say, does this road go to Tel Aviv? Am I talking about laying the tar? I'm sorry, if the road starts here, how long does the tar go? Is the other end of the tar at Tel Aviv or not? I'm not talking about building something. It's already been built. It was built 40 years ago. I just want to know what its path is. The first half describes putting the ladder in position. It was set earthward. So here I say, well, it was set earthward to the earth, towards the earth, and it wasn't obviously coming from the earth. The storage warehouse of the ladder is not on the earth. It's someplace else. They took it out of the storehouse, set it up towards the earth. Then it must be stored above. The second half says, now that it's been put in place, how big is it? I'm standing here at the bottom. I see it going up, you know. Sort of gets misty the higher up you go, more indistinct. Where is its top? The top reaches to heaven. So the second phrase describes how big it is after it's put in place. There's no contradiction between the two phrases whatsoever.
Where does heaven mean in this context?
Upward?
I don't know exactly. I don't know exactly. I don't know how to define it exactly. But it's clearly above. Now, the question will be, Oh, so the implication that it comes from heaven to earth is a good implication, even though the second half of the phrase ends with heavenward. Now, I claim that you're stuck here. If you pay attention to the meanings of the words and the contrasts between the subjects and verbs, there's nothing else you can do here. Don't tell me it's talking about chess. Don't tell me it's talking about recipes for pasta. Don't tell me that it's transvestites. You know, leave that for Yale. That's what the words say, the literal words say, and that's what logic requires, and that's what it means. Period. You with me? Okay, this is an ideal case. Let's do the second half, which is not ideal. Let's say, what are your questions?
Why does it say it was there? So it was said. So the water was there, earth, you know, from, excuse me, different wording, would it change that much?
Because you couldn't say it was there, earthward. To the earth has to mean, it has to go with the verb of either reaching or being put.
It was coming from the earth, it was coming earthward.
Then you did coming, not was there. Correct. That's fine. But then, if I had asked, if it had said coming, you'd have said, why doesn't it say set? I mean, you know, at that point, the words are more or less interchangeable for the pshat, I think. Okay. Now the second half. We can skip to behold for now. Now, angels of God is not a good translation because in Hebrew, the word malach means messenger. And it can refer to human beings as well. It can refer to human beings that people send to one another. It does not have to do with angels. So really, it should be messengers of God were ascending and descending on it. Now here, there's a difficulty of a more general nature. This ladder connects heaven and earth. You see, we're being told that there are angels going in both directions. What here is different from what you would have expected?
Come down.
Where's the home base of the angels? Presumably in heaven. So if so, if they're making a round trip, it should say they're descending first and ascending afterwards. That's what it should say. You also might ask what angels are doing with a ladder, since the angels are usually pictured as having wings with which they can fly, you know, so they fly, tripping up and down the ladder. Okay. Now, here's another aspect of interpretation. When you have difficulties in a verse, sometimes, when you're very lucky, you can deduce the answer to the questions, as I did in the first half. Then you are nailed shut. There's no way you can budge. That's got to be what it means. Sometimes you can give an explanation which answers the questions, but you have no proof that this is the only possible explanation. It's satisfactory, and it fits in with other places in the text, which means that it's reasonable. But you have no proof that this is the only possible interpretation or explanation by the other explanations. Both types of interpretation are legitimate. If you feel a bit nervous about explanation because there's no proof that it's unique, let me remind you that in science, all you ever get is explanation. You never get a proof that it's unique. You never get a proof that there can't be another theory that does a better job. So, let's not look down on or despise explanations. And here is a way of explaining the order of the angels in the second half of 12. This dream takes place when Jacob is on his way out of the land of Israel. He's leaving the land of Israel. What is on Jacob's mind is, will my leaving the land of Israel destroy my future, destroy my destiny, and destroy my relationship with God? That you can see from the beginning, from the continuation of the dream, and the vow he makes on the next page. The whole dream addresses his worry that he's being cut off because he's leaving the land of Israel. After all, his grandfather Abraham lived in Ur Kasdim and lived in Haran for decades and was childless, and finally God said to him, you can't have children here, you can only have children and start the Jewish people in the land of Israel. The land of Israel is special, unlike every place else. So now, Jacob, for other reasons, is leaving, and he's worried that he's losing out. He's being cut off. And the whole dream is to reassure him that he's not being cut off. Now, here's the explanation. The explanation is that the angels symbolize and express, carry God's relationship with Jacob. And what God is telling Jacob is this. You're leaving the land of Israel, that's going to cost you. You're right to be worried. When you leave the land of Israel, you're going to lose the angels that have been accompanying you until now. Those are the angels going up the ladder. They're the angels that have been assigned to Jacob throughout his life until now. But you will not be utterly cut off. You'll not be utterly cut off. A different band of angels will accompany you outside the land of Israel. And those are the angels that are coming down. So indeed, it is a replacement. The angels that he has are leaving him, and others are coming to replace them. A hint to this explanation is found on page 169. Here's Jacob coming back after 20 years of absence, coming back to the land of Israel. Verse 2 at the bottom of the page. Jacob went on his way, and messengers of God encountered him. Same phrase. Malachi Elokim. Messengers of God encountered him. Jacob said when he saw them, "This is a godly camp." So he called the name of that place Machanoim. What does Machanoim mean in Hebrew? Nope. Ah, good for you. Camp. And indeed it means twin camps. The ayim ending in Hebrew means twin, like you're dying for hands and you're dying for eyes and I was dying for ears and I'm dying for legs. And, right? Now, let's understand this. He sees a group of messengers of God. He says, this is a godly camp. And therefore he calls the name of the place Twin Camps. Doesn't that sound a bit funny? Why would he call it Twin Camps if he saw a godly camp? So true, some commentators say, well, you know, there's my camp of people and there's that camp of angels. So we call it Twin Camps. But twin doesn't work out too well if one camp is a camp of people and the other camp is a camp of angels. But if you say that the angels that he was given coming during his period outside the land of Israel are still with him, and these are the Israeli angels coming to meet him, and there's a temporary overlap between the two camps, then it reads very well. He's been carrying around his camp of Mossad angels, you know, the CIA angels, the external angels with him. And now the Israeli angels are coming to meet him. For a moment of time, the two camps are present in front of him. And indeed, that's why he says the name of the place should be Machanoim. One more point, and then I'll take questions. Now, back to 145. We are now assuming a principle. If the two camps overlapped on his way back, why would that be? Why would they overlap? Why wouldn't there be a smooth interface? One's leaving, the other just take over. So the principle would be that the higher angels move first. The higher angels move first, and the others move only in consequence. Back at 145, which angels are ascending the ladder? Israeli angels. That is the higher group of angels. They ascend, and only afterwards do the external angels descend. Coming back on 169, the external angels are with him. The Israeli angels move first, and there's an overlap. Right? Okay, so now back at 145, if the Israeli angels move first, and the external angels only come afterwards, what are you going to get? Yes, but you're also going to get what? If coming back there's an overlap, then over here there's going to be an absence, a blank. There's going to be a gap. Right? The opposite of overlap is a gap, right? Now look what it says in 13 and 145. 12 angels of God were ascending, the messengers of God were ascending on it, and behold, Hashem was standing over him. Why? Why is Hashem standing over him? Because there's a gap! There's a gap! There are no angels there. And therefore, for that moment, God has to protect him himself.
But it's just descending.
What's that?
First, the angels go up, then the angels come down, and then after this, there's such a
descending. Okay, you can't say everything all at once, right? Doesn't say he came to stand, says he was standing. So if I use this explanation, these details all fit the explanation well. Now, that is not a deduction. That cannot be put on a par with the first half of the sentence. The first half of the sentence with the deduction, there's no way out. Here I have an explanation. I have an explanation of the order here, and I have an explanation of what it says in 169, and I have an explanation of 13. All of it fits consistently into one explanatory picture, together with the context that he's worried about leaving the land of Israel. It all fits together. Could there be some other explanation which fits all the details as well or better? I don't know. I have no way to prove not. I never heard one, but I have no way to prove not. So at this point, what you have is an acceptable explanation and interpretation, because nothing is wrong, we have no objections against it, and in principle, the floor is open for later thinkers to come up with other explanations, which could be as good or better. Yeah.
Of the going up, down, and then God standing over.
It's if you know some Hebrew grammar, it's very good. Dine malach elokim olivio vimbo, dine Hashem nitzav alav. It's a verb versus a really what a verbal noun. Anyway, are you with me? Good. Now, so I give you one more. Only if it's relevant to interpretation. I don't want to lose the focus of interpretation. Okay. All right, look at 147. I'll just take you to one more. Top of the page. Jacob awoke from his sleep. This you can even get in the English if you read carefully. In the Hebrew, it's even more belated, more obvious. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely Hashem is present in this place, and I did not know." Now here we have to move to a different plane altogether. Jacob says, "Surely Hashem is present in this place, and I did not know." I mean, so what if he didn't know? Why is that important? You know, things happen all the time that I didn't know. Look outside, it's raining, or the telephone rings, and somebody calls. Did I know who was calling me? I didn't know who was calling. That's why I pick up the phone, and so I say, "Oh, gee, it's so-and-so, and I didn't know." You're confronted with new information all the time. If you had to say, "I didn't know," every time something happens you didn't know, you'd be saying it all day long. Why would someone say something like this? What's the point of saying, "I didn't know"? When in normal human life do people say things like that? You want to talk first? You want to talk first? Let me see if he did say surely.
It's apologetic, isn't it?
You've done something different. Yeah. Oh. When do you say "I didn't know"? Usually it's an excuse. Or an explanation. It's usually under challenge. Why did you do that? I don't know. I didn't know. Don't hold me responsible. Usually, I didn't know is an excuse. So, if he says, and he's speaking, he's sort of speaking to himself, there's nobody else there, right? He says, Hashem is present in this place, and I didn't know. So the natural thought is, and if you had known?
You wouldn't have slept there.
Oh. So that's what the commentators say. Because nothing else has happened to you. Right? If you had known, you wouldn't have slept there. The fact that Hashem is present there, whatever that means, makes it so holy, so important, so special, that you shouldn't have gone to sleep there. That's what they say. Now, if that's true, how are you going to understand 18? Jacob arose early in the morning. Oh, he did he? Arose early in the morning, huh?
I had a question about this tomorrow.
Wait a second. Let's get people register the problem. Right? Sounds like 18 implies that he went back to sleep. Now, so how then in 16 can we understand him as saying, oh, Hashem was present here and I didn't know? Of course, if I had known, I never would have gone to sleep. And then he just drifts off, you know, and goes back to sleep till the morning. Like, it's very peculiar. Right? Now look carefully at the words, boys and girls. There isn't even room for this question, but of course you have to learn how to read. Look at the words.
It's
part. Mm.
You can wake up and then get up.
Waking
up and getting up is
closing
the
mix. Arise. 16 starts with one verb and 18 starts with a different verb. It's not the same verb. Even in English, it's not the same verb. Awoke is one thing and arose is not the same thing. Now, many Hebrew speakers do not know what the corresponding Hebrew word means here because they've gotten used to it in a particular context. Lashkim. Lashkim Avraham, Yaakov Aboker. Lashkim does not mean to wake up. It doesn't even mean to get up. It doesn't mean to arise. As my middle son taught me, Lashkim in Hebrew means to start activities early at any period of time. Any period of time. Lashkim means to start periods, activities early. Proof. Everywhere in the Tanakh, where it means early in the morning, it always says, Vayashkem, Baboker. It always puts in Baboker. Why does it put in Baboker in the morning? Because without Baboker, you wouldn't know when it is. Furthermore, and this is what my son pointed out to me, when God says to the prophet Samuel, I'm disgusted with Saul, I don't want him to be king anymore, the Nach over there says that Samuel prayed to God all night. Prayed to God all night by Yashkein Baboker. That doesn't mean he woke up early in the morning. It doesn't mean he got up early in the morning. He prayed to God all night. It means that when the morning came, he started his morning activities early. It has no implications about being asleep or being in bed. And indeed, in Rabbinic Hebrew, and I think the Rabbinic Hebrew is following the Biblical Hebrew here, every morning you talk about Hashkama, space of Medrash, Shachris, Ve'arvis. It means getting early to the house of study, morning and evening. You can be Lahashkim Ba'erev also. Lahashkim just means starting the activities of a period of time, early for that period of time. That's all it means in Hebrew.
But in Hebrew it doesn't say early.
I understand. What does Lashkem mean?
In Hebrew, it's to include early, so it's embedded in the Ashkem here in Hebrew.
Yes, Lashkem means, the definition of Lashkem means to start the activities of any time period early. And that's why in Hebrew it always says Baboker, because otherwise you wouldn't know what time it was. Okay, so therefore there's no contradiction whatsoever between 16 and 18. But in order to see that, you have to pay attention. And as I've told you many times, this is not the New York Times, and this is not even the Wall Street Journal, which is a good newspaper. You have to read carefully. You have to read repeatedly. You have to read with attention and with logic. And when you do, you find all sorts of interesting things. Okay.